What kind of suffering have the people of Gaza endured after 7 months of assault from Israel? Is the solution to the Middle East conflict rooted in religious conflict or claims on land, not unlike the claims in Canada of indigenous land? Were the stories of Hamas beheading Israeli babies and raping Israeli women all made up? Did the unusual warnings from U.S., Egyptian, and even Israeli intelligence point to incompetence on the part of the Israeli government or evidence that they let it happen on purpose? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with Nakba Day coming in less than a week, we return to Gaza at a time when they are experiencing what some people call a second Nakba, and look at the costs so far from the ongoing carnage by Israel of the Palestinians on the Strip. In our first half hour, we speak with Louis Al-Ghul, a Winnipegger with ancestry and many relatives living in Gaza, about the impact of the Israel-Gaza war on his loved ones, the current genocidal rage as Nakba 2.0, and the roots of the conflict in indigeneity. Then in our second half hour, we are joined by British journalist and filmmaker Richard Sanders about his recent film, October 7, exposing the truth and lies about Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, which tragically altered the region. On this week's program, revealing the myths and realities of Israel-Palestine struggles and of October 7. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 10th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Nene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The European settlers who came to this part of the world received the great assets of the land and waters through false promises and treaties. The unequal treatment resulted in colonialism and genocide. Today's generation should be aware of this background and should devote themselves to changing their relationship with the indigenous people to one of respect and forge a path toward reparations and reconciliation to compensate for lost trust. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station.
Yes, it does seem clear that the collapse of dollar hegemony could lead to World War III if the U.S. decides, out of desperation, to simply knock over the chessboard now that it is in danger of being checkmated. The U.S. had previously been heading toward bankruptcy around 1970 due to huge budget and trade deficits coming from the Vietnam War. So, the Nixon government, also acting in desperation, removed the gold peg, while the banking oil cartels raised oil prices by a factor of four. It was done by the U.S.-British financial class, not by the Arab oil producers. What it really represented was a gigantic theft of international resources by these cartels. That was from the transcript of a conversation under the headline, "The Collapse of Dollar Hegemony Could Lead to World War III, Richard C. Cook," by Richard C. Cook and Ahmed Daniel Arif, posted May 8th, originally published on the Review of Religions. These contradictory postures by the White House cannot conceal the critical role of the U.S. in perpetuating the genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. The policy orientation of Washington is leading to greater instability, not just in Palestine, but internationally. In Gaza, The health ministry reports say that over 35,000 people have been killed, while more than 70,000 are wounded and injured. Thousands of other bodies, including many women, elderly, and children, remain trapped under the massive rubble of destroyed residential, commercial, and public structures. An intensification of attacks on Rafah will generate even worse conditions for the civilian population already living under dire circumstances. That comes from the article IDF Enters Rafah, Blocking Aid to the Gaza Strip, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted May 9th. If the story of this senseless slaughter has been told to the world, it is not simply because of the courage of the journalists associated with the conventional media. The alternative media have also played a significant role. Within the alternative media in Gaza are a large number of citizen journalists telling the truth to relatives and friends through their hand phones and other channels. They too are heroes and heroines because of their indomitable courage and their willingness to take great risks, risks which place their very lives in peril. It is because these citizen journalists had shared their stories with certain conventional media channels, which in turn had scrupulously verified the news and information they had received, that so much of what was and is happening in Gaza is now known to the world. That comes from the article Genocide in Gaza, Kudos to Journalists Who Tell the Truth, by Dr. Chandra Muzaffar, posted May 9th. The usual solutions are to cut programs or raise taxes, but both approaches are facing an uphill battle. Raising taxes would require a two-thirds vote of the legislature, which would be very challenging and worthy. Public programs are in danger of getting axed, including homelessness prevention and funding for low-income housing. A third possibility might be to increase the income tax base and state income by stimulating the economy with a state-owned depository bank. The state-owned Bank of North Dakota, which has raised record profits for its state, is a stellar example. In a review of states with the healthiest budgets, based on data from the PEW Charitable Trusts, U.S. News and World Report puts North Dakota at number one in budget balancing and number one in short-term fiscal stability. That comes from the article, Tackling California's Budget Crisis, Raise Taxes, Cut Programs, or Form a Bank, by Ellen Brown, posted May 9th, first posted as an original to SheerPost.com.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
On the Global Research News Hour, I had a chat with Luel Al-Ghul. He's a Winnipegger with family living in Gaza. He relayed how the deaths of several relatives since Israel's attack affected him.
Since October 7th, you've lost a number of relatives in the war. Would you care to say
Sure.
how many?
Yeah, so in since October 7th, we've lost 74 family members. People I knew, that's not including distant and friends. But before that, we also lost other family members in the other raids on Gaza. We lost 11 family members in the one before this one as well. And it's very heartbreaking to speak with the survivor ones right now in Gaza. And I talk to them almost on a daily basis. Some of them we were able to take to Egypt temporary for medical treatment. And I'm actually leaving on Friday, day after tomorrow, to go and see what we can do to support them over there. Yeah.
Just give us a couple of examples. I mean, people who are particularly close to you?
Yeah, so the closest one is my uncle, my father's brother, who passed away, and he died from starvation, unfortunately, and malnutrition. And that's another thing people don't realize, that the stage that they're in right now is we are losing a lot of people, children, elderly people, and people with lower immune system to starvation, malnutrition, bad water, and the climates. So the last one we lost, it was my uncle, who basically I grew up with and I knew him very, very well. Yeah.
Yeah. So I imagine, like, just, you know, from my own experience, when you lose a loved one,
yeah,
that could be very you know, arresting and so on, but you're losing dozens in a few months. I mean, I can't really imagine what that must be like for you.
It's been extremely difficult, very, very difficult for me. I've since October 7th till about March 1st, I wasn't glued to the news, and yeah, also overseas. Stress level was to the roof. I would sleep about 3 to 4 hours a day maximum. I'm up all night because of the time difference, and on the news and so on. And the stress was so high to the point where I suffered a heart attack on March 3rd. And so, you know, I actually am very blessed for what I have, and have nothing to complain about compared to the people who are living there. Seriously, nothing. I'm very blessed to be here.
So, what have you heard from your relatives in Gaza? What have you been hearing about their experience with the attacks? Have they been able to connect with you? And what was their experience like?
I'm using terms that have been used by the International Court and by Amnesty International and so on and so on. It is nothing short of a genocide. So there is a collective punishment where there over 70% of the people who have been killed are children and women. And that's the same in my family. Like one extremely sad case, as you know, the attacks happened all over Gaza. Now, most people have moved to Rafah, which is in the southern border next to Egypt. And now they've been, Israel has announced 2 days ago that they are going into Rafah as well. So during that movement from the north to the middle, to like from Shatta, from northern Gaza, from Khan Yunis, people were killed even walking and moving from one place to the other. A sad story about the saddest story, I would say, is about a young child, a relative of ours, who her family were all killed in on northern Gaza, except for her. And not the sadness of the death of the family is one thing, but the horrible situation of knowing that there's a child alive with no family members around her, and trying to facilitate her movement from there to Khan Yunis at that time to be with some family. That was 10 days of hell for us, for the whole family, and for me. So things like this, people actually don't understand the severity of the situation. There's the bombs that are being thrown on Gaza. They're 2,000 kilograms bombs. The amount of bombs that were thrown on Gaza is more than Second World War. I mean, you're talking about a 40 kilometers area, 40 by 40.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the devastation that's happening there? There is 80% of the hospitals, 80% of the schools, over 86% of the homes were all destroyed. Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, used the term that they're going to carpet clean Gaza and destroy Gaza that way to to allow for settlers to come in and take over. So this is a second Nakba after the first one that happened in 1948 with over 750,000 Palestinians taken out of their homes and killed to make space for the Western settlers coming from Europe to take their homes. And actually, many of these homes are still standing where their home, where they were just taken by from Palestinians and just taken by the settlers. So the issue is not a complicated issue. The solution is not a complicated solution. The solution, people ask me, well, this has been going on for 200 years. It hasn't. It has been only going on for 75 years. Mm. They say that this is a religious conflict. It is not. Palestinians are Jews and Christians and Muslims and Baha'is, and been like that since until 1948.
Anti-Semitic refers both to Palestinians and to Jews.
Yeah, I have a nice challenge to anybody actually who is here in Winnipeg. I'm happy to meet with them. Just to kind of clear this concept, I'm happy to do a DNA test with anybody who claims to be from Israel. And if they have more Semitic blood in them than I do, DNA blood Semitic than I do, I will give up my Palestinian inheritance. You can. Our family traces back all the way to Kenyans. We are the one who hosted Abraham, who came from Iraq, and we welcomed him. And he had two wives, Sarah and Hagar, who was a Egyptian, and two children, and his children Isaac married Palestinian Kenyans, and his children, two boys. One of them is Jacob, that we know Jacob, also married two wives, also Palestinians Kenyans. So I'm here in Canada since 1989. I have children who were born here in Canada. Hopefully, grandchildren also will be born here in Canada. None of my children and grandchildren can make a claim to say that they are indigenous people of Canada. And the same thing applies to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, which we love, by the way, we love and we host and we value, but you cannot say that they are indigenous people of Palestine. Mm. They intermarried with us. And I can intermarry with, well, no, I can't. My wife will kill me, but my children can intermarry with an indigenous people of Canada, but they themselves cannot be indigenous. What I'm saying is, this is a situation where people have to understand that when somebody says, I'm a Palestinian, he doesn't mean a Muslim. He doesn't mean Christian. He doesn't mean Jew. He means the people of that land. And a story, I would just say a very quick story. In 1948, we come from a village called Sarafand al-Amar. It's very close to a city called Lid. And 1948, in May 1948, the militia, the European militia, came in and tried to occupy our village. So the people of the village, especially men, went in to fight those militias. The women and children left the village because to run away from the fights. After the fight finished, my grandmother went back. And my grandmother tells me the story. I was 11 years old, and she says, your grandfather died in that war, and I went to look for his body, and I had your uncle, my youngest uncle Muhammad was with me, and we were looking for the bodies of your grandfather Shahada. So we're looking and we're twisting the bodies and moving the bodies to look for him. And she's telling me the story. Mind you, I was 11 years old.
Yeah.
And at that age, the understanding of what is a Palestinian came to me. It was very clear to me at that time. She says, I'm flipping the bodies and I see, Muhammad. I flip the body and I see Dawood, in Arabic means in English David. I flip the body and I see Mikhail, which means in English Michael. And I was like, wait a second, Grandma, who's David and who's Michael? I thought you're going to say Arabic names like Hassan and Osama. She's like, no, these are our neighbors. David is our Jewish neighbor and Michael was our Christian neighbor, and they all went in to fight this militia, Western invaders. Wow. So Palestine had...
This is since 1948, of course.
This is up to 1948, before the declaration of the State of Israel. So we had anybody who looks at the history, at the currency or the coins of Palestine, at the stamps of Palestine, you know, before 1948, he or she will see that there is Hebrew writings on the coin and an Arabic writing on the coin. Mm-hmm. He or she will see that on the postage, the same thing. There were libraries of Jewish and Christian and Muslim libraries, because we are one nation. It doesn't matter what religion you are from.
Yeah.
So in 1948, we had settlers who came from Europe because of one of the worst human catastrophe, which is the Holocaust, happened in Europe, and we had settlers and refugees came to Palestine from Europe. Same thing when Abraham came from Iraq to Palestine as well. We welcomed them and we hosted them. And then they took arms against us, and they mm-hmm. declared the State of Israel in 1948. Up to that time, we had no idea why would they do that, but clearly it was a promise that was made to them by Balfour, the Prime Minister of Britain, promising the Jewish people in Europe a land in Palestine, our country. What right did he have to do that? Why didn't they give him a land in Germany, for example? But the point is, this happened. Now there is a State of Israel. Now there is Palestinians. Now there is an apartheid state, unfortunately. Not according to me, by the way. It's according to International Court and Amnesty International and other organization, accredited organization and scholars, where people in that land are treated differently based on their skin color and their religion. And that's really horrible to have in the 21st century. This is the problem.
Mm.
So what's the solution? Somebody will come to me and say, well, what is the solution? Well, the solution is to treat everybody equally, to treat everybody with justice, to give the same right to everybody, whether regardless of your religion or your background, and to recognize the indigenous people of the land, and just to say to them, we're sorry 1948 happened, and we want to live together peacefully. And we've done this in Canada here. Mm. We've took the steps in Canada after centuries of arrogance and centuries of, and by the way, we're still going through the discrimination and racism in Canada, but we came long way since, you know, what we did to our beautiful indigenous population. We have to do the same over there. And we have to say to them, let's live together. Nobody's going to throw the other one in the sea. Nobody's going to kill the other person. Let's all live together under one umbrella. Call it Israel, call it Palestine, but recognize what Palestine is and treat people equally. This is my view, at least. Some people might disagree with me, but I say this with all my heart. I don't think any Palestinian, and I don't think any Israeli open-minded person would mind living next to each other peacefully, if there was justice and equal rights and so on.
Yeah.
Very simple, really.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier how the what's happening now is like a second Nakba, right?
Yeah.
And I was wondering, could you give me any insights, like, or rather, did experiencing this now, like firsthand, you know, the deaths of all your relatives, does it give you a unique, or are you looking at Nakba 1948 in a different way, or maybe appreciating it more?
Well, absolutely. Like, I am my dad, I would say, is better than me. My dad survived both the first Nakba and losing his father, getting killed. And the second Nakba, losing many relatives, including his brother. And the second Nakba, I say this with confidence that this is the second Nakba, because over 1.6 million people were displaced now from their homes. And the first Nakba, it was over 750,000. So it gives me an appreciation of what people went through. And the good thing for people who are opening their minds and their hearts and their eyes to what's happening is that social media actually has been an amazing tool in showing us the pictures of the people who are going through this, who are moving from one place to the other, raising white flags and still getting killed, humanitarian workers coming to give aids and food and still getting killed, doctors and nurses who are giving aid equally, by the way, to everybody and still getting killed. My cousin's husband, his name is Salim. He is now in Egypt for getting treated for heart issues from Gaza because of what happened. He's a doctor. He's a surgeon in Gaza. And when October 7 happened, I called him. And I said to him, what's going on? Are you guys okay? And so on. You know what he said to me? He said to me, like, I am in a very unique situation. And I am very blessed because I am treating both Israelis and Palestinians. This was actually October maybe 12 or 14, something like that. I can't remember exactly the date. People when Hamas went into Israel and captured those prisoners, brought them back to Gaza, they were injured. Some of them were injured, and he was treating them, and he was also treating Palestinians, and they were all next to each other in hospitals.
Wow.
And he's saying to me, he had nothing to do with it, but he said to me, as a physician, I'm in a very unique situation to be providing aid and treatment for everybody, and it makes it he's very humbled by that. When he was saying this to me, in my mind I was saying, if this situation was reversed. And actually, it did get reversed when Israel entered into Gaza. Did they provide the same aid and care to Palestinians? Did they actually look after them? Did they actually provide? I've never, since October 7th till now, I've never seen any footage of any Palestinian being treated by an Israeli hospitals or Israeli mobile tents and so on. And you know, what really breaks my heart is seeing the IDF, their name should be changed from IDF to IIF. They're not defense, they're invaders. Should be seeing them and seeing the Prime Minister of Israel and seeing the officials in Israel recklessly and arrogantly saying that, why can't the Palestinians go to Egypt? We're here for Hamas. Why can't they go to Egypt and clear Gaza for us? What an arrogant thing to say. You know, number one, you took over the land in 1948. Number two, you're occupying Gaza. Now, number three, now you're carpet cleaning Gaza. And now you want them to leave their land, homeland, those indigenous people, to another country. Why don't you take them? If these are innocent and you're only after Hamas, which is, by the way, not true. They're after all Palestinians. But if they're only after Hamas, why don't you bring these innocent people into Israel?
Yeah.
Go strip them naked from everything and make sure they have nothing of a weapon of any sort, but take them into Israel and host them there until you clear the issues that you're saying with Hamas. Yeah. How can you make such a statement? Why can't the Arab world open their doors to the Palestinian and take them into their countries? What an arrogant thing and an inhuman thing to say.
I wish you well and on your trip out to Egypt to see your relatives, and I hopefully that you and your neighbors among the Israelis you can have some sort of a.
I hope so too.
Yeah,
I hope so too. And I want to say it's very important to say that anti-Semitism is unacceptable. There are people right now who are Jewish people who are being targeted, and they're being attacked, and that's unacceptable in any means or form. But at the same token, don't be afraid to criticize the government of Israel. That's not anti-Semitic. Don't be afraid to criticize any government in the world if they are against human rights. That's fine. And don't associate a government with religion. You know, Netanyahu government is a government that it's a racist government. It's a horrible government. And it's doing injustice to the Jewish people, which we respect and love. Mm-hmm. And I think as soon as the war is finished, this guy is going to go to jail. and he's trying to prolong the war to run away from that.
Okay. Well, Louis Gaal-Ghoul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And yeah, all
thanks
the best.
For having me. Thank you.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
The deaths of hundreds of Israelis, the deaths of thousands of Palestinians, the fronts with Lebanon, the involvement of the Houthis in Yemen, and now possibly a major war with Iran, and the major focus of media attention in the world presently. All these developments flow from one day of infamy, the October 7th, 2023 attack. The largest attack on Jews since the Nazi Holocaust has set the stage for appeals to Jewish solidarity, Israel's determination to end the siege once and for all, and the sympathy of Israeli supporters around the world. This event was very much like 9/11 in the United States. But a documentary came out about 2 months ago by Al Jazeera's investigative unit, I-Unit, which conducted an extensive forensic analysis, including hours of footage from CCTV, dash cams, personal phones, and head cams of killed Hamas fighters, and came to the conclusion that while there were widespread human rights abuses by Hamas fighters and others who followed them through the fence, from the Gaza Strip, the frequent stories put out immediately afterward, including the mass killing and beheading of babies, as well as allegations of widespread and systematic rape of Israeli women, were false. Joining us to talk more about the documentary is Richard Sanders. He's the director of October 7th and an award-winning TV producer, journalist, and author. He has made more than 50 other films, mostly for British Channel 4, public broadcast television station. Richard Sanders, thank you so much for agreeing to this interview. It's a pleasure having you on.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Now, your documentary does not dispute the notion of that human rights abuses were conducted by Hamas and others, but the major themes were of the brutal crimes toward babies, children, and women. You point to the I list, which your group tabulated, and point out there is no connection. Talk first of all, if you can, about what you came to know about the deliberate falsification of these incidents, first towards the babies and then towards the raped women.
Now, whether falsification was deliberate or not is something that can be discussed. I mean, I think in some cases people were drawing conclusions from the state of bodies and so on. In other cases, it's very hard to see why people were telling the stories they were telling. I mean, first of all, let me say that the film is not an apologia for Hamas and others who followed them through the fence. We're quite clear that widespread human rights abuses were committed on that day. Close to 800 civilians were killed. But yeah, the principal point we then make is that many of the worst stories, the stories that really portrayed the Palestinian gunmen as psychopathic sadists, as people who belonged outside of the family of humanity, those stories, for the most part, were not true. And you're right, we focused particularly on two areas. Firstly, the babies. Because this was what really made the headlines in the days immediately after October the 7th. There were reports that 40 babies had been killed at one kibbutz, that many of them had been beheaded, and so on. Now, this one is fairly simple and fairly straightforward. We did a lot of work to draw up a very comprehensive list of the dead. And there are two babies on that list of the dead. One, an 8-month-old child who was killed when a bullet was fired through a safe room door in Kibbutz Beri. The other, a child who died after an emergency caesarean when the mother was shot, a Bedouin lady. Now, any story about murdered, mutilated babies, which does not correspond to those two, and there are a lot of stories about the murder and mutilation of babies, all of those stories are untrue, and we know that from the list of the dead.
Well, what What about the crimes against women? You know, there was like all over the place. There were people who were or women who, I mean, putting out stories that said that there was widespread rape. What did you reveal in that environment?
The issue of sexual violence is more complicated. The baby issue is important because it shows that stories put out by the Israeli government, by the Israeli Defense Force, and crucially by first responders could not be trusted. Those were the three key sources for stories about babies, and the stories turned out to be entirely untrue. Now, that obviously, you know, as a journalist, that has significance for you when those same sources start telling you stories about other atrocities. And the fact is, with sexual violence, again, they were the main sources. Now, again, to be clear here, we're not saying there were no rapes at all on October the 7th. It's possible there were. Frequently there are acts of sexual violence in conflict situations. What we're saying is there is simply not the evidence to support the Israeli assertion that there was widespread, systematic, instrumentalized, weaponized rape. That there's nothing close to the level of evidence that one would need to support that assertion.
Well, you mentioned there was this commentator, it was Madeleine Reese, who was basically a kind of an expert in these sorts of things. And she said that in spite of your video saying that these people were, they reported their rape to the Israeli body, and they said, well, we can't investigate because that rape can be considered legitimate, a resistance or something like that. And she said, no, we do have mechanisms by which you can, we at the UN, where we have a committee which investigates these crimes, and it was blocked by Israel, apparently.
That's right. I mean, what Madeleine's referring to there is a video we feature in the film, which is an Israeli propaganda video where they're sort of mocking the UN and international women's organizations and saying, you know, claiming that they are indifferent to the suffering of Israeli women. Madeleine was making the point this is entirely unfair. There is an official commission of inquiry set up at the UN to look into human rights abuses in this part of the world. It immediately offered to come and look at them, and the Israelis blocked it, you know, because they don't trust the UN and they regard the UN as an unreliable source. But, you know, it certainly isn't the case that the UN was indifferent and didn't want to investigate. It did want to investigate. So one of the big problems, and there's a whole range of problems. One is that the Israelis have this odd practice of farming out the collection of bodies in situations such as this to an organization called Zaka, an ultra-religious organization. Now, you know, these people are amateur volunteers, and I think on October the 7th, they were simply overwhelmed. And you just don't have the sort of professional forensic collection of bodies that would normally happen in situations like this. So it's very hard now to retrace our steps and get back to and to work out what exactly did happen to people. Now, you know, with rapes, there are certainly no victims that have come forward. Now, people will point out that that might be because they're dead, which is a perfectly valid point to make. There are remarkably few witnesses. Now, many of these stories regarding rape concern this music festival, which was an open-air festival. And although hundreds of people were killed at the festival, thousands of people were not. And there are limited numbers of witnesses that have come forward. There are two eyewitnesses in particular, one of whom is a police witness and is anonymous. The other is a young man who was there. You would think, if rape was widespread and systematic, you would have more witnesses. It's peculiar, the lack of witnesses that have come forward anyway. And that's a fundamental problem with the evidence. There's no forensics. There's no forensic evidence to support these allegations at all. Again, that could be to do with the chaos of the collection of the bodies.
Well, wait a sec. You're saying hundreds of the attendants of the Nova Music Festival were killed, but thousands had actually attended. And I mean, do you have any instance? Are the people refusing to talk, or are they being contained somehow? How can that be?
They're talking. I mean, they're talking about their experience all the time. What I'm saying is that they're not saying that they witnessed rapes.
Oh yes. Okay. Well, I'm wondering, because you've been in mainstream media for a while. What mistakes would you say were made by the major media? Because I mean, this was circulating throughout all the major publications, right? I mean, what were there actual mistakes that were made, or is this something that's kind of understandable in an instance like this?
I think it's a mixture of the two. There was a tendency amongst an awful lot of media to simply accept the Israeli narratives, which really, if you're professional journalists by now, we should have learned to be very, very sceptical of anything the Israeli government or the Israeli armed forces say about Palestinians. So I think that was poor on the part of a lot of media not to scrutinize what the authorities were saying. The rather peculiar situation with this one is that you have these first responders and volunteers, people like Zaka, United Hatzala, and so on, are also coming out with these stories. In fact, they're the main source of those stories. Now, here, I think to a degree, Western media can be forgiven, because if you or I, as journalists, Michael, turn up at an accident site or the site of an atrocity, and the ambulance driver and the doctors and so on start telling us stuff, you know, normally your default would be to believe it. And I think it took some time for people to work out that you could not rely on what you were being told by Zaka and others, in part because they were amateurs, they were not forensically trained, they did not have the skills to interpret what they'd seen, in part because the information was straightforwardly unreliable, it turned out. Now, with the babies, you know, it was fairly, if you were doing your job properly, it was fairly quickly clear that many of these stories about 8 babies dead here, 40 babies dead there, and so were just untrue. They were just, you know, straightforwardly untrue. And once you'd grasped that, people should have been more wary when people started coming out with the stories about sexual violence. And there wasn't sufficient scrutiny paid to this. I mean, the most notorious example is the huge New York Times piece, which came out just after Christmas, which they've had to backtrack on a few elements of that story.
Mm. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of a story released in 1990 in the lead up to the Persian Gulf War about there was a nurse claiming to see Iraqi soldiers taking babies out of incubators and throwing them on the floor. It never happened. Okay, the nurse was the Kuwait ambassador's daughter, trained by Hill and Knowlton, the company. And I'm wondering, what do you think motivates these types of lies about children and babies and now women in the face of other activities that were actually performed by some elements of the Hamas groups of fighters?
I think it's fairly straightforward. If you go back through history, if you have a group that you feel the need to crush and destroy, you have to dehumanize them psychologically. You have to dehumanize people if you're going to kill them in large numbers. And again throughout history, you see this with slave revolts. You see this with, you know, First Nation people in Canada and in the United States and so on. What they are accused of is rape and murdering babies. It's the two things people always get accused of in order to dehumanize them, and therefore in order to legitimize the violence that is then used against them. It's always the same pattern.
Just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and we're talking with Richard Sanders, who's the director of the film October 7th, a forensic analysis of the attacks on the day of October 7th. Richard Sanders, you also mentioned in the film the Hannibal principle, the idea that it was better for soldiers and hostages to die than to be captured. I mean, this is an actual principle, right?
It's a doctrine. It's a doctrine the Israelis first adopted in the 1980s. It's, you know, it wasn't like it was something they officially announced or anything, but it's, you know, it was widely reported on and accepted. And yes, and basically in the past they'd got themselves into situations where one or two or three Israeli soldiers might be abducted, and they'd find themselves exchanging hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners in return. And they took the decision that it was better if someone had been abducted, it was better to kill everyone, you know, the hostage takers, but also the hostages, than to find themselves in that situation. Now, that doctrine was supposedly, reportedly rescinded a few years ago, but the reporting in the Israeli media is that a version of it was revived at midday on October the 7th. And that Israeli Apache helicopter pilots and Israeli ground troops were pursuing a policy of killing hostages if necessary, rather than allowing them to be taken hostage. Now, again, it's so difficult pinning down figures. How many people died as a result of this is very hard to know. And I think some people have rather run with this and gone with rather inflated figures. You know, some suggest more than half of the people killed that day were killed by the Israeli forces themselves. I don't think that's true or anything close to the truth. But certainly it would seem a number of Israelis were killed by their own forces on that day.
Well, you talked about in the film that, initially it was a high number of 1,400, and then they brought it down to 1,200 because some of the people were killed were actually Palestinians. And not Israelis as they had originally intended. So that, and like, why would the Palestinians kill themselves, you know?
Well, there were Palestinians who'd been killed, you know, in the course of the repression of the incursion that day. The point was a lot of the bodies were so badly burned or mutilated and so on that they were originally mistaken for Israelis. I mean, the obvious question there, once the Israelis, Mark Regev, the spokesman, had come out and said, look, we hold our hands up, we got it wrong, 200 of these bodies were Palestinian, not Israeli. That begged the obvious question. For weeks and weeks they'd been telling us appalling stories of the mutilation and burning of these corpses and how difficult it was to identify them. Now, if they suddenly turn around and say, well, you know, 200 of them were Palestinian, that does obviously beg the question, well, who burned and mutilated them?
Yeah, and when they were taking hostages back to, when there were hostages being kidnapped, a lot of them were killed in between the place of take to the Gaza fence, correct? Like,
well,
70.
I mean, again, it's because the collection of bodies was so chaotic and poorly recorded. I think it's a huge source of frustration for the families of many of the dead that they really can't pin down the circumstances, the when, the why, the how, and so on, that their relatives died. We managed to identify at least 27 people who we are sure were kidnapped. They were taken hostage. They weren't killed in situ, as it were, in the kibbutzes. They were taken hostage, and they died somewhere between their home and the fence. And we don't know how they died. And what we're saying is, there's a reasonable chance that a number of them were killed, particularly by Apache helicopter fire. I mean, again, people, particularly at the music festival, there are some suggestions that the Apache helicopter fire was really responsible for a very large number of deaths. Now, one of the reasons I rather shy away from that is similar to my logic about the rapes and the lack of witnesses for rapes. If the Apache helicopters were killing large numbers of hostages as they were taken back, you would expect more witness accounts of that. You'd expect more direct first-hand witness accounts of that, and there are not. And there's only one absolutely concrete, solid witness account of helicopters firing on a vehicle holding hostages. Now, there were 9 hostages in that vehicle, 3 of them children. Miraculously, only one of them was killed. But as I say, there are 27 people who die in unexplained circumstances between their homes and the fence, having been taken hostage.
Well, I want to go back like close to the beginning of the film, in which they talked about, or actually how you talked about how the Israelis had gotten warnings of the of an attack that would be coming out by the by Hamas. I mean, there was one woman in particular, and she had raised flags all the way up to the chief of military intelligence, and they seemed to say, well, at least what you said in the whole movie was that they were maybe overconfident or taking part in. Basically not taking seriously, and they really erred. But you know, Richard, I mean, I remember hearing Efrat Fedigson, who served in the IDF 25 years ago, saying that there's no way Israel did not know of what's coming. You know, a cat moving along the fence is triggering all forces, and to me, this surprise attack seemed like a planned operation on all fronts. I hosted a U.S. foreign intelligence officer in October who said that with Egypt and the U.S. themselves having relayed advance warnings and the cameras and surveillance drones present along the fence and Hamas training intel indicating they were planning to go through with this training to go into Israel out in the open. So, you know, that indicated to him that therefore, Israel wanted this action to go forward. So, I mean, I guess you can see the conspiratorial lines I'm going down. But, I mean, do you think
Of course, if you were such as the atmosphere in Britain, I don't know what it's like in Canada. If you said that in Britain, you'd be absolutely slaughtered as an anti-Semite for such conspiracy theories. But you can see why these theories arose, because it was extraordinary, the failure of intelligence and the collapse of the military. But also you're right that the Israelis clearly knew that Hamas had this plan and clearly knew that they were training for it, and they clearly knew that on that night there were suspicious movements on the other side of the fence. Now, the thing is, with intelligence cycles, I mean, you know, somewhere deep in the bowels of the Pentagon, there is a plan for invading Canada if it's ever necessary. I mean, just because people have a plan to do something and are prepared to do something doesn't mean they're about to do it. And I think that was, you know, the Israelis, they clearly got it wrong. It was hubris. They felt Gaza was contained. They felt Hamas was contained. I think they thought they were just whistling in the dark. They were keeping up their courage. They were, you know, this was morale boosting stuff for the troops. And they got it wrong. They got it completely wrong. I mean, you know, even if we entertain the possibility that perhaps they were prepared to allow something to happen, I think we can be pretty sure they assumed it was something on a far, far smaller scale.
I just wanted to say, like, I understand you can't come to any quick conclusions, but certainly you could at least decide whether or not it's relevant to have an investigation into the attacks. This is like they had an investigation into the 9/11 attacks in the United States. I mean, is there a... You know, is that something that could be brought forward as a possibility?
Well, the Israelis are quite clear that they will hold an investigation, but it'll take place once the conflict in Gaza finishes. I mean, the big question is when the conflict in Gaza is going to finish. And clearly the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, has a problem in that once there is a reckoning for what happened on October the 7th, it's not going to be good for him. You know, I imagine the military intelligence, the Shin Bet, the government, they'll all shift blame backwards and forwards between the three of them. But for all of them, it's not going to be good.
Mm. Well, anyway, you've put out this film, and recently, it's basically Al Jazeera has been shut out of Jerusalem. I mean, I'm wondering if there are, do you have any indications as to whether it was your movie that might have been a prominent reason to blame for the policy of excluding them from...
No, they haven't specified. I mean, of course, Al Jazeera's news side, Al Jazeera English, also does superb coverage from the Gaza Strip. I mean, in my view, it's incomparably better than any Western news channel is doing from the Gaza Strip, and I shouldn't imagine they're very keen on that either. So yes, they raided and closed Al Jazeera's Jerusalem bureau the other day. They're also blocking Al Jazeera in Israel, so it can't be viewed in Israel now. So, you know, I always say to people, please do share the film as widely as possible to try and overcome this sort of censorship. There's also sort of a conspiracy of silence amongst Western media as well. And one of the problems quite often with what we do at Al Jazeera is we point out the failings of the Western media, which means that the Western media isn't terribly keen on covering anything we do. So, you know, the only way around that is for people to share as widely as possible the output we do produce. So the film is available on YouTube. It's called October the 7th. And I would encourage people to share it.
Yeah, just maybe a last question. What exactly inspired you to make October 7th as a forensic analysis of the day? I mean, did you have doubts about the news on the wire from the start? Or
yes, I'm freelance, but I do quite a lot of work for Al Jazeera. And within a few weeks of October the 7th, I was getting on to Al Jazeera and saying, look, this, you know, this reporting just so obviously raises so many questions that we really need to do this, because clearly, you know, the BBC and CNN and so on are not going to really scrutinize this and ask the questions that should be asked. And we need to do it because no one else will. And you know, Al Jazeera agreed with me.
Okay, so Richard, is there anything else you'd like to say about the making the film and then the content that you'd like to expose to the public before we close?
And I think that's it. I think we've covered it all, really. No, I think we've got it all.
Okay. Well, Richard Sanders, I'm afraid we have to leave it there, but you've provided us with a thorough portrait of October 7th, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it with you in more detail. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Michael.
Richard Sanders is an award-winning TV producer, journalist, and author, and he directed the recent film October 7th, and as he said, it is available for free on YouTube.
Dylan Saba, staff attorney with Palestine Legal, stated back in October that the leaders of Harvard University student groups were doxxed and smeared for signing a statement also expressing solidarity with the Palestinian people. Their names and faces were plastered on a mobile billboard truck that roamed around campus for days, and a college terror list circulated online accusing them of anti-Semitism. In this context, it is pivotal to salute those individuals participating in encampments at universities across the United States and around the world. In Canada, many state students intend on sending the message of not being implicated in Israel's genocide in Gaza by receiving support from Israel's institutions and companies. Divestment encampments are now taking place at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, the University of Victoria, McGill University, University of Toronto, UBC, the University of Ottawa, Ontario Tech University, Vancouver Island University, Western University, McMaster, and in the University of Calgary. We will focus more on NACBA for the next episode, from both past and present, and of all the actions and camps speaking out against the tragedy. Listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Ojibwe, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.